This is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated October 26th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Today's front page, top of the fold, Bonus Pay Multiplies at UNC Healthcare, by Jason DeBrun from Chapel Hill. Even as UNC healthcare leaders have held back on pay raises for employees during a tough economic period that has legislatures peering into the system's finances, they have been increasingly generous in doling out pay bumps in the form of bonuses or incentives. Since 2008, incentive pay to a broad set of employees across UNC hospitals in Chapel Hill has more than doubled, and that total payout is 36% higher than in 2007, second only to 2011 as the highest total in the past 6 years. Bonuses are on the rise as a hospital system has cut back on base pay incentives. In 2009, no employee received a base pay increase, and in 2010 and 2011, the system made modest marker adjustments for our employees, according to the annual report to the UNC System's Board of Governors. Moreover, hospital executives say bonuses might become increasingly used as a way to increase pay without hiking salaries. That is, in part, because salaries for all employees of UNC Chapel Hill, including those in the healthcare system, have been posted online since 2009. While the posting was done in the name of transparency, hospital leaders say it's made the hiring process more difficult because some prospective employees don't like their pay to be publicly known. "We are now experiencing the repercussion of those realities," states a UNC healthcare report to the University System Board of Governors regarding the salary postings. For instance, in order to attract qualified and experienced talent in some fields where the labor market is tightest, including information technology, it may be necessary to offer cash hiring incentives rather than higher base pay. This pressure will only continue to build in areas of scarce labor for specialty talent. Although UNC Healthcare is part of UNC Chapel Hill and falls under the UNC system, it acts as its own entity in several ways, including its personnel system. University employees fall under the State Personnel Act and are more closely governed by lawmakers on Jones Street. Last fiscal year, which for the healthcare system ended June 30th, UNC Healthcare paid $11 million of incentive compensation spread across the equivalent of 6,691 full-time employees. That compares to $4.9 million paid out in 2008. "These incentives are paid on an all-or-nothing basis," explains Karen McCall, the healthcare system's vice president for public affairs. "Leaders establish system-wide goals in six areas, and if those goals are met, the eligible employees receive a percentage of their gross pay as a bonus. Last year, the rate was 2.7%. This year, the rate is 2.76%, the highest since 2007, when the percentage was 3%, the maximum allowable. Total payouts have increased at a higher clip relative to the number of employees receiving bonuses. This means that individual bonus checks have been increasing. Since 2006, the number of eligible full-time equivalent employees has increased by 48%, while the total payout has increased 86%. Since 2008, in the wake of the financial crisis, the number of eligible employees has increased by 31% and total payout has increased by 124%. A move toward more incentive pay is something that is increasingly happening throughout many businesses, says Molly Hedgman, director of human resources at CAI, a human resource management firm in Raleigh that tracks salaries across many industries in the state. "Putting a larger percentage of overall compensation on variable pay gives employers the flexibility to adjust how they pay based on how much they take in. UNC Healthcare has paid out at least $4.9 million of incentive pay for at least the past 6 years, raising the question of whether employees see it as incentive pay at all or just part of their total compensation package. Last year was, by most measures, a good year financially for UNC Healthcare. The system reported $121 million of operating income and set a record for net patient service revenue at $1.16 billion. In total salaries and benefits, the system paid out $597 million last year. As for university and other state employees who went 4 years with no pay increases, the 2012 General Assembly appropriated funds to support a 1.2% annual salary increase. In August, the UNC System's Board of Governors approved salary administration rules for faculty and other employees who are exempt from the State Personnel Act. Those employees were to receive a salary increase of not less than 1.2% for the 2012-13 year. In addition, each campus was authorized to use other resources, if available, to develop a pool of up to 1.8% from which additional salary adjustments could be made for retention, merit, or equity, says Joni Worthington, UNC System Vice President for Communications. The total pool available for such salary adjustments could therefore be made up to 3%. Next up on the front page, better future ahead, but it won't be fast. By Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. The North Carolina economy is expected to begin growing at a faster clip, around 5.5% or better, in late 2013. But a modest hiring rebound won't begin until 2014, when the recovery takes a firmer hold. The predictions are those of New York-based Moody's Analytics, which recently fired up its crystal ball to produce a statewide economic forecast through 2017-18. Among the findings, job growth, limping along at about 53,000 jobs added this year, growth is projected to hit the 102,000 mark in 2014. The year after is even better as the number jumps to 121,390. Housing, sales of existing homes are forecast to run 10 to 15% below the 2006 peak through 2018. Gross state product. Expanding at less than 4% now, the state's economy is projected to grow at 5.5% in 2013, matching the 20-year state average. The year after, the forecast is for growth of 6%. Salaries and wages. Workers' pay in 2013 is forecast to grow at a rate of more than 4.8%, the long-running state average. Moody's Analytics, a division of the bond rating agency, uses metrics from factory output to housing starts to death rates in producing long-range economic forecasts that are purchased by countries, states, and even metros. The North Carolina prognostication was the product of multiple sources, says General Assembly fiscal researcher Barry Boardman, who cautions, however, that error increases the further you go out. Another Moody's finding. North Carolina retail sales, which began rebounding in 2011, will flatten out to about 5% growth rate by 2013 and stay there through 2017. Observers looking at the Moody's forecast point out that the numbers are statewide averages. Regions of the state that escaped the deepest troughs of the recession, the triangle among them, they say should be expected to see a faster bounce back. That's certainly true in case of housing, says Alan Tate real estate agent Tom Bowman. I think things have already snapped back here, says Bowman, who adds that demand for new homes is already outstripping supply in Cary and Wake Forest. Customers placing orders with national home builders working the area are facing waits of 4 to 5 months. Meanwhile, existing homes aren't moving that quickly as of yet, and the prices they are fetching are still below 2006 levels, he says. I think it'll take another year and a half to 2 years before they get back to that, says Bowman. That's my read on what's happening at the Triangle. I can't speak for the rest of the state. As for housing, the Triangle market should also outperform the state as a whole in labor force improvements, says Chapel Hill-based analyst John Quintero. As to put Moody's 2014 estimate of 101,770 jobs created in perspective, he responded that it would be a big improvement over current conditions. It's a good number, but the fact that it's coming 2 years out doesn't offer a lot of hope to people now, he says. Still on the front page, bottom of the fold, a flower of power. NCSU researcher hopes to develop battery of the future. By Lauren K. Onisores from Raleigh. They're as pretty as flowers, and a North Carolina State University professor theorizes they could become brutish enough to replace the expensive and outsized batteries now used to power electric cars. Professor Lin-Yu Cao and his team have created flower-like structures out of semiconductor material called germanium sulfide, or GES, that hold promise of being developed into next-generation energy storage devices. Call the structure nanoflowers. They are that beautiful and that small, small to the point that they can only be seen when magnified. Not magnified, what's seen is a yellow glint on a piece of silicon that's smaller than a fingernail. The ones with the nanoflowers are colored, Kyle points out, poring over a whole drawer full of tiny fragments. While nanoflowers aren't a new concept, these flowers, which vaporize chemicals into the flower shape, are made from thinner sheets with a larger surface area, meaning potentially greater energy storage than what's out there now. We're trying to improve capacity, he says, adding that the technology is already exceeding his expectations. Cao is declining most interviews about the technology because he doesn't want to raise expectations. Indeed, we're not there yet, he says, referring to a battery prototype, but he hopes to be able to fully demonstrate the technology's potential in the next year or so. That's why he's been tight-lipped. His encouraging findings could, however, be good news for those in the auto industry who have become disheartened due to the dearth of consumer interest in battery-powered cars. The latest U.S. BEV market study reports that just 2% of respondents to a survey expect their next vehicle purchase to be electric. And a new report by J.D. Power and Associates shows that consumers expect electric car batteries to offer a range of 156 miles, 50% more than what most electrical vehicles can currently provide. The latter is the problem Cal is trying to solve. John Peterson, an attorney and consultant who gave the keynote address at the recent European Lead Battery Conference in Paris, is familiar with nanotechnology. While he notes the materials can do magic in terms of increasing energy storage, the technology is expensive. Additionally, it takes at least a decade for new materials and chemistries to get into battery production, he adds. The last thing I would ever want to do is to discourage anyone from working because we desperately need the help, he says, adding that he hopes Cal is successful. Lowering that price is difficult simply because of the rarity of the materials required, particularly in the battery, which is often the most expensive part of an electric vehicle. He explains it in global production terms, noting that electric vehicles are built to save resources, including oil, coal, natural gas, which had global production levels of about 14 billion tons last year, or about 2 tons per person. When you get to the reality, to the really scarce material, things like lithium that's used in the battery, rare earth minerals like cobalt, their global production is like 100,000 tons, he explains. You're talking about using more cobalt or lithium or more rare earth metals to save energy resources that are 100 times more plentiful. Vince Caprio, executive director of the New York-based Nano Business Alliance, says the price tag isn't what is deterring consumers from buying electric cars. Rather, he says, people aren't convinced the cost is worth giving up the rides to which they've become accustomed. Caprio points to A123 Systems, a Michigan-based electric car battery maker that received a $249.1 million federal grant before its recent bankruptcy filing as an example that demand matters more than innovation. In order for Cal to be successful, that demand is going to have to catch up to the research, he says. Cal may have time for that to happen. He has yet to talk to any company about commercialization options and says his technology is several years out before it might be found in a car. But I do hope so someday, says Cal. Continuing inside the front page, Nelson Mullins plots growth in local office. By Chris Bagley from Raleigh. The Nelson Mullins Law Firm is seeking to expand the size of its office near Crabtree Valley Mall as it hires attorneys for healthcare, government relations, and the financial services area. The Columbia, South Carolina-based firm has about 30 attorneys in its Raleigh office and a handful of government relation advisors. Managing partner Noah Hufstetler says the firm has added 3 lawyers since the spring and would like to add about 10 more in the next couple of years if it can get another 10,000 square feet. The Raleigh office, one of 13 for Nelson Mullins, was launched with 5 attorneys in 2003. "We are just full," Hufstetler, a healthcare attorney, says of the firm's 26,000 square foot second floor suite on Park Lake Avenue. One attractive option would be to occupy part of the space on the third floor that ShareFile is vacating, Hufstetler says. Other tenants in the building include Myers Bagel, a law firm that focuses on patents, trademarks, and copyrights. ShareFile, a division within Citrix Systems since its acquisition last fall, is in the process of moving to a much larger space once the Dillon Supply Warehouse on West Street in downtown Raleigh is renovated. Hufstetler says he's also open to moving to a larger space owned by the same landlord, Highwoods Properties. Nelson Mullins' expansion contrasts with trends in the legal services market as a whole. Most large firms shrank in 2009 and 2010 and have only begun to stabilize in size. The Triangle's 17 largest firms had about 838 attorneys this spring, down from a peak of 852 in 2008, according to annual surveys by Triangle Business Journal. "Firms are not expanding a lot," says Tom Kane, a legal market consultant who is based in High Point. "In this day and age, if anything, firms are downsizing. Some new frugal corporate clients are also pushing their firms away from hourly billing and towards fee-fixed structures. Meanwhile, a few large firms have lost entire practice groups in the last couple of years as attorneys try to serve clients with less overhead." Mac Paul, a former partner with the national law firm K&L Gates in Raleigh, who recently co-founded Morningstar Law Group in Durham, says Nelson Mullins' footprint in the southeastern U.S. may help the firm keep fees relatively low for clients. "National firms tend to have high rates," Paul says. "There are synergies that exist if you're focused on one geographic region," says Paul. Next up, unemployment tax going up to pay off the federal debt, by Lee Weisbecker. This article is from Raleigh. North Carolina companies in 2013 face an increase in federal unemployment taxes they pay as the state continues to look for ways to repay $2.5 billion it borrowed from the national government to pay jobless benefits. The deadline for repaying the loan without any additional penalties is November 10th. When the state missed a similar deadline in 2011, companies saw their 2012 federal unemployment, or FUTA, FUTA, bills increase by 0.3%, or about $21 a worker. The same increase is expected for the current tax year. At the height of the recession, there was hope that the U.S. Department of Labor would forgive the debt, which grew to such a massive proportion as the state tried to keep pace with job benefits for the unemployed. "That's not going to happen," says State Representative Dale Fowell of Winston-Salem. Fowell is co-chairman of a House committee looking into various legacy costs North Carolina faces in connection with the state health plan, pension system, and the Employment Security Commission, which has now been folded into the North Carolina Department of Commerce and is called the Division of Employment Security. The 9-member committee may make a recommendation to the General Assembly next year on the best way to repay the $2.5 billion. "A lot of groups are working on the problem," says Fowell. "It's a complex issue." All told, 36 states tapped the federal government to help make benefit payments as their own employment security trust funds vanished under the weight of advancing job losses. Some 20 states still have outstanding obligations totaling a combined $227 billion, according to General Assembly fiscal researcher Kristen Walker. North Carolina's debt level currently ranks third behind that of California and New York. FUTA penalties kicked in after the state had not repaid the loans for 2 consecutive Januaries. However, the state has made 2 interest payments at 2.904% on the loans totaling $162 million. The North Carolina Department of Commerce hired a Michigan consultant to look into repayment options. The consultant's 277-page report came out in May. Included were a range of remedies from selling special bonds to generate cash, to cutting the level of benefits being paid out to recipients, to raising the rates on the other tax North Carolina companies pay, the state unemployment, or SUTA tax. SUTA rates currently range from 0 to 6.8% on each employee's salary base of $19,700. The General Assembly is expected to examine the menu of possibilities next year. A possible way of dealing with the matter would be to do none of the above and pay nothing back. Under that scenario, the additional FUTA tax penalties would continue to kick in annually. Funds raised by that other method would pay off the federal borrowing by 2019, according to the North Carolina Treasurer's Office. However, that's not an option with winning any friends among business groups. The Raleigh-based North Carolina Chamber, which has been actively involved in the debate, issued a white paper of its own, written by Ohio attorney Anthony Fiore, that recommends a mix of fixes, including the SUTA rate increases, benefit cuts, and bonds. Gary Salamito, the Chamber's Vice President for Governmental Affairs, says the group plans to lobby for a resolution of the issue in 2013. We're hopeful, Salamito says. We want to see a comprehensive solution to make the system solvent again now, but also ready for when the next recession hits. The next article is entitled Made for China. U.S. subsidized Durham plant may ship vaccines overseas. By Lauren K. Onisors from Durham. A Canadian company that operates a vaccine plant in Durham that was built with $21 million from the U.S. Department of Defense in order to boost the nation's flu vaccine supply could wind up pumping out vaccines for China. The company, Medicago, is teaming up with a Philip Morris International subsidiary to break into the billion-dollar Chinese vaccine market. Medicago CEO Andy Sheldon says the recently signed commercial license agreement with PMI promises an upfront payment from PMI of $4.5 million and the potential of $7.5 million in milestone payments and additional royalty for influenza vaccines. It gives us a pretty good validation of the process and the products we've manufactured so far, and more importantly, the platform, Sheldon says, adding that this means at least a 5-year relationship for Medicago and PMI, which owns about 40% of Medicago. Philip Morris has a significant presence in China, and as such, is a company that really has the potential to help us get into that marketplace. That marketplace, according to Calorama Information publisher Bruce Carlson, is worth $1.4 billion, compared to a world vaccine market of $19.8 billion, and Sheldon says that's a big enough number to push Medicago completely onto the world stage. This is one country, but a very large country, Sheldon says, adding that heavy focus will still be placed on the United States and Europe. Roth analyst Scott Henry says the deal reflects on the potential in larger markets, adding that China represents less than 10% of the influenza market, and that the U.S. could command about 5 to 10 times that of China. While it's still early in the deal-making, there's a chance that the bulk of the vaccine work will be done at Medicago's Durham facility. Medicago built the 97,000-square-foot Durham facility in 2011, for a total of $42 million. Besides the DOD's $21 million, Medicago contributed $7.5 million to the project, and Virginia-based Alexandria Real Estate Equities Incorporated invested $13.5 million. Within that contract, there is the right to manufacture in China, if that's what our partner decides to do, Sheldon says. But it's entirely possible that we use a U.S. facility. The local facility was intended to fend off a U.S. pandemic, but Sheldon says it's capable of more. The plant can produce 10 million doses of pandemic flu influenza vaccine per month, and on an annual basis has the production capacity of 40 million doses of seasonal influenza vaccine or 120 million doses of pandemic influenza vaccine. To prepare for the global vaccine industry, the Durham facility is going through an upgrade, financial terms of which were not disclosed. It is an upgrade that should happen anyway to follow global standards for clinical trials, he says. Now that Medicago has officially gone global, the Durham facility is too, with validation and updates to be completed by 2013. Additional upgrades will follow, he says. It's going to mean a tremendous amount of work, he says, adding that the facility is multipurpose. Though the facility is known for its influenza work, it can also accommodate other vaccine production. While Sheldon couldn't specifically comment on any new hires to accommodate the deal, he did say it's a logical next step. The more expansion we go through, that's generally the pattern, he says, adding that the facility already employs more than 50 people. Much of its research and development happens at its headquarters in Quebec, while much of its manufacturing happens in Durham, particularly in influenza. The company also has a laboratory in France where it's conducting research on yet-to-be-disclosed products. PMI would not say where it was leaning regarding manufacturing in Durham versus China. Our focus in the short to midterm will be on the preparation and successful completion of clinical trials and obtaining the necessary regulatory approvals in China, spokesperson Oklisi Konechigong says, adding that this is just a side business for PMI. The manufacture and sale of cigarettes and other tobacco products in markets outside the United States continues to be the core of our business. Continuing inside, Towerco CEO gave investors huge gains with a $1.45 billion sale. By Lauren K. Onisores from Kerry. It's hard to argue with the decision to sell out the company's entire inventory when it results in a 100% plus gain, especially during the worst economic crisis in almost 100 years. That's the upshot in the summer sale of Towerco's 3,000-plus cellular towers to Boca Raton, Florida-based SBA Communication for $1.4 billion. Consider the math. Towerco paid $684 million for the towers 4 years earlier. The sale could have resulted in the shuttering of the Kerry company, but Towerco's well-heeled private equity investors are ready to go at it again by letting CEO Richard Byrne rebuild the company's inventory with the goal of a repeat performance. Towerco makes money by leasing its towers to telecom companies. You have to get back into startup mode, Byrne says of Towerco, which cut its staffing from 75 to 24 employees following the closure of the SBA deal. The Iowa purchase put the company back in the game, in Byrne's words. We have a pretty good runway to grow the business. It's not going to be this deal. Byrne is building up Towerco's dry powder. He already has raised $150 million from investors, including New York-based Soros Strategic Partners and New York-based Vulcan Capital. Those backers have a total of $740 million in Towerco, and they'll put in more, Byrne says. History is on his side. The summer SBA deal is his second successful out. In 2008, the company sold 430 towers to SBA for nearly $200 million, allowing investors an exit. Soon after is when his team purchased the more than 3,000 towers later sold to SBA. Money is not anything that ever keeps me awake at night, he says. My concern is having deals we understand that make sense to us. It's a difficult deal market, says Ken Schmidt, a partner with Swarthmore, Pennsylvania-based Steel Tree Partners. Schmidt, who assisted Towerco in its first sale nearly 6 years ago, says there aren't a lot of big tower packages out there for Byrne to snap up. That will leave Byrne looking at small to mid-sized portfolio companies, such as Land O'Lakes' Florida-based Skyway Towers. If I were in Towerco's position, I'd certainly be looking at any of the mid-tier tower companies that have been in existence 3 or 4 or 5 years, says Schmidt. Skyway has more than 250 towers in its portfolio and more than 100 sites in development, and also netted a recent $65 million debt facility with Goldman Sachs Specialty Lending Group. Its CEO, Dan Behunik, says it would not consider selling its towers to Towerco at this time, but deals do pop up, Schmidt says. Schmidt says it's likely that Byrne will look for companies a lot like Towerco. Even though Towerco's recent purchase of was of Towers in Iowa, most employees will continue to operate in Cary as they did when Tower Co.'s assets spread across nearly 50 states. That means Byrne will be looking for deals not necessarily specific to the region. The IWS sale comes with a 5-year exclusive build-to-suit agreement and the opportunity to acquire future towers IWS may bring to market. The transaction, valued at $45.5 million, is expected to close in the fourth quarter. IWS CEO Craven Shoemaker says the deal will support IWS's expansion in Des Moines. IWS is a partnership between T-Mobile USA and Iowa Network Services, INS. Tower Co. was founded in 2004 by Byrne and Scott Lloyd, Chief Operating Officer, with initial backing from New York-based Tailwind Capital. Next up, UNC, other universities working to link research globally. By Lauren K. Onisorge, from Chapel Hill. Researchers at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill are creating a social network similar to Facebook, but instead of friends, researchers will be finding collaborators. UNC's DataBridge project involves one of 8 teams nationally that are splitting $15 million in grants from the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation. The goal of the program is to help users find data that's relevant to their projects, prompting them to expand their research and create cross-disciplinary collaborations. Basically, there are thousands and thousands of scientists all around the country producing data sets, the project's senior research software developer, Howard Lander, says. There isn't a good way for somebody not just to find a particular project, but to have a good idea of what's of interest to them. A scientist researching global storm surges, for example, might have data that would be useful to a sociologist studying retired people moving to the beach. One data set shows you where all these people live, and another data set shows what happens in a given storm, Lander says, adding that in order to connect these projects currently, scientists have to be specifically looking. DataBridge would utilize databases currently in place, such as Dataverse, and organize them in different way, making suggestions that researchers might find interesting and relevant. Researchers will be able to connect through the system, and new partnerships and projects could emerge through those connections. You can start talking, Landers says. The project also involves researchers from the social science, social work, and political science departments at NC State University. Researchers at Harvard and North Carolina A&T State Universities are also partners in the project, as is Chapel Hill-based Renaissance Computing Institute, or RENCI, RENCI. RENCI Communication Director Karen Green explains the system. If you use Amazon, you buy a certain book. It will give you suggestions of other things, she said, adding that the system would suggest areas of research to the scientist in a similar way. There are tens of thousands of scientists creating smaller collections of data, but if you integrate all that data, it is a very large collection. But nobody knows each other, Principal Investigator Arkot Rachigiu says, adding that the cloud-based system will be expansive, but would only need to contain the data needed to make connections between the research projects. Eventually, the project could have licensing applications outside the research space in helping pharmaceutical companies find a drug development partner, or in generating a new way for a Fortune 500 company to arrange its own data records. Eric Rotenberg, a professor researching and developing processors at NC State, says the project sounds very useful. Some of the highest impact research is to be had at the intersections of disciplines, as it leads to unconfined thinking, says Rotenberg, who was not involved in the project. Next up, Wake Tech to work with SAS and IBM on analytics curriculum. By Jason DeBrune, from Raleigh. Wake Technical Community College wants to train the technicians who will do the grunt work of building a smarter planet. Borrowing the phrase that software company IBM has come to own in its marketing, Wake Tech will launch an associate's degree in business analytics beginning in 2013. Also, with the help of a $3 million federal grant, the college will begin a separate program to certify students in business analytics, a curriculum that college officials believe to be the first of its kind in the nation. The college will use educational software from IBM, based in Armonk, New York, and SAS, based in Cary. For the associate's degree portion of the initiative, Wake Tech will target students who will be required to earn a full 64 credits, including general education courses. For the grant-supported certification program, displaced or underemployed workers will be targeted and required to earn 12 credit hours to gain a certificate of training. The grant comes from the Trade Adjustment Assistance Community College and Career Training Initiative, administered through the U.S. Department of Labor in coordination with the U.S. Department of Education. It is the largest grant in Wake Tech's history, and Wake Tech was the only community college in North Carolina to receive an individual grant. In addition to the software, Wake Tech will look to recruit faculty from IBM and SAS, says Brian Ryan, the college's chief academic officer. The Wake Tech programs, as opposed to business analytics curricula at a 4-year universities, are aimed at filling a need for workers who are trained in the field at a less advanced level. NC State University, for example, offers a 1-year Master's of Science degree in analytics in addition to bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees in statistics. There are a few programs, however, that offer a business analytics degree at a lower level, says Ryan. This grant is the right funding at the right time, says Carol Cutler-White, Dean of Sponsored Programs and Federal Relations at Wake Tech. Business analytics is an emerging field of employment. The push into business analytics makes sense. McKinsey & Company, a global management consulting firm headquartered in New York, estimates that by 2018, the nation will lack 1.5 million analysts who can make strategic decisions using big data. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics predicts there will be a 24% increase in demand for professionals with management analysis skills in the next 8 years, and a recent IBM Global CIO survey of 3,000 companies found that 83% of respondents identified business analytics as a top priority. IBM, which has a large operation in Research Triangle Park, already works with more than 200 academic organizations worldwide to expand analytics curricula, says IBM's Ari Fishkind. Employers welcome a workforce with technicians trained in business analytics in order to become more efficient. Analytics is a growing field across the country and probably world, says Robert Michaud, manager of IT Business Services at Coastal Federal Credit Union in Raleigh. Businesses want to understand who their customers are. They want to understand their businesses better. Ryan says Wake Tech projects an enrollment of between 40 and 50 students in the first year and about 100 by the second for the associate's program. For the certificate program, Wake Tech expects about 100 by the second year and 150 by the third year. A credit hour at Wake Tech costs $69, so a full associate's degree would cost about $4,500 and a certificate about $828. And now, capital. Take of $70 million speaks to Square One's lending model. By Lee Weisbecker. From Durham. Venture bank Square One's successful $20.6 million fundraiser marks the second time in the past 28 months that the specialty lender has offered common stock to investors. Back in June 2010, it raised $48.5 million to fund growth and to shore up its capital base. Combined, the two efforts brought in nearly $70 million, an enviable record during a time when most conventional banks still run into brick walls when trying to raise fresh capital. In fact, in 95 recent bank capital raises charted nationwide by Sudharan Agrawal of Charlottesville-based SNL Financial, only 9 were pulling in amounts hitting $70 million or above. Founded in 2005, Square One uses a string of loan production offices stretching from Boston to Austin to Silicon Valley to lend to new and developing and often venture-backed tech and life science companies. They have found the ideal business model for the current pervasive corporate environment, Duke Associate Finance Professor Ed Turikian says of Square One's lending model. The high-growth areas of technology and life sciences look particularly attractive in this slow-growth economy. After California-based venture-based banking vet and bank founder Richard Casey died in November 2010, the Square One board brought in Bank of America alum Doug Bowers to chart the company's future course. Casey's wife and co-founder, Susan Casey, maintains a seat on the 12-member board. Over the past 15-plus months, under Bowers' direction, the bank has grown total assets by 28% to $1.8 billion and net loans by 18% to $723 million, according to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. In terms of deposits, Square One, with $1.6 billion, is now North Carolina's 10th largest bank. Bank officials did not release the identities of the investors who took part in the latest $20.6 million fundraiser, but did allow that shares were sold to existing institutional shareholders. One institutional buyer back in 2010 was a Philadelphia-based private equity group, Patriot Financial Partners, which at the time came away with a 19.9% stake in Square One. Asked if the group had taken part in the latest round, Patriot's Kirk Wyckoff declined to comment. In a press release on the latest capital raise, Bowers says the bank will use the cash for organic growth and strategic initiatives. Plans to bring in 3 new senior-level executives for the bank's Silicon Valley lending office were announced following news of the successful fundraiser. Attempts to reach Square One Vice President Greg Thompson for further comment about the bank's growth were not successful. One factor that prompted Square One to turn to investors back in 2010 were losses it took on mortgage-backed securities held by the bank as core capital. Such losses hit $30 million in 2010, declining to $8.9 million for all of 2011. In the first 6 months of 2012, Square One has recognized a net gain of $238,000 on its securities portfolio, according to FDIC. This week's spotlight is on technology, and this article is entitled "Company Subbing Chips for Scribes" by Lauren K. Onisorge from Durham. 600 a second. No, it's not a measurement of engine speed or a hummingbird wing flaps. It's the number of articles that Automated Insights creates each Tuesday for fantasy sports teams everywhere. Yes, articles, in the way that the story you're reading now, or listening to now, is an article. We take data and turn it into stories automatically, CEO Robbie Allen says. We, in the case of that quote, being the company's proprietary software, along with some human touches. Our technology humanizes big data sets by spotting patterns, trends, and key insights and describing those findings in plain English that is indistinguishable from that produced by a human writer, says AI's website. Grown to this point by more than $5 million in venture equity from NC Idea Fund partners, Box Group, OCA Ventures, and Court Square Ventures, AI recently gained some national buzz by signing a deal with giant Yahoo, in which it provides game recaps and other articles for millions of people who manage their fantasy sport teams through the Yahoo website. AI, originally called StatSheet, uses a system of algorithms as well as stylistic techniques from writers on staff to create unique content. Originally, the company had hoped to publish the content itself. Allen, who started AI while working for Cisco Systems, soon saw more benefit in partnering with other companies that already had built audiences. It takes about 2 hours and more than 100 servers to generate the millions of recaps. We were focused on personalized content. By producing articles specifically relevant to a reader, Allen says, AI is actually reducing what is read. You have to read a lot of stuff to be able to get the information you need, he says of traditional net news grabbing. If more content was personalized, you could read less content. In fact, some articles may appeal only to a handful of people or even an audience of one. But it's really interesting to them, he says, so that's okay. Sports make up most of AI's business, but the company also has clients in real estate and finance. Most of the new inquiries about the technology are not sports-related, so that's where the growth potential comes in, Allen says. How far will automated content go? Allen says it won't put journalists out of a job, for now, but someday he hopes technology will emerge that can make the writing even more human. Journalism experts don't see that happening anytime soon, but admit they're watching AI and companies like it. Andy Bechtel, an associate professor of journalism at UNC Chapel Hill, says the rise in automated content means reporters, the humankind, will have to up their game. They're going to have to increase the quality of their writing, he says. UNC Associate Journalism Professor Ryan Thornburg says readers will be able to tell the difference between human writing and computer writing on the page, and the fate of human writers will come down to one question. Do people like the stories or not? From this week's opinion page and the editor's notebook, an article by Sugata Mukherjee, the editor of the Triangle Business Journal. This article is entitled, Using Lynch's Formula, My Prediction on Housing. Noted mutual fund manager Peter Lynch, who managed the Fidelity Magellan portfolio in the 1980s, often said he would walk around malls and grocery stores to get a feel for what consumers think about a company's products. Based on the consumer excitement level, he would invest in those companies. Lynch was handed managerial duties of the Magellan Fund in 1977 with $18 million in assets. By the time he left in 1990, the Magellan Fund had grown to $14 billion in assets and averaged a 29.2% annual return. His formula worked. Playing Peter Lynch for a brief moment, I think the housing market in general is about to make a rousing recovery. Why? In the past month, I have come across prospective home buyers and real estate brokers who are saying things I haven't heard for at least 3 years here in the Triangle. A house in the Brittany Woods neighborhood in Raleigh had several bids within days of being put up for sale that essentially started a bidding war, according to the person who won the bid. A real estate broker who works at our building told me she is doing 3 or 4 showings a week. Until recently, she was lucky to have 3 or 4 showings a month. On October 24th, the U.S. Commerce Department announced that new home sales rose by 5.7% to 389,000 units in September, the highest level since April 2010, when a federal home buyer tax credit inflated sales. Similarly, we reported less than 2 weeks ago that new and existing home sales in the Triangle improved by 19% in September to 2,001 homes under new ownership. These numbers are still below what housing industry experts call healthy. But home buying is like a game. When people who are in the market for a home start reading columns like this one, that might prompt them to make an offer in fear that someone else would. And inevitably, the folks who lost the housing start second-guessing that their bid was too low. A housing comeback will ripple through our local economy. Once the rebound is sustained, the mortgage broker industry will perk up again. Banks will be in better shape, and that all amounts to jobs. That was my Peter Lynch moment. Now back to the work at hand. This week's guest column is from Brenna Birch. Ms. Birch is a policy analyst at the North Carolina Budget and Tax Center in Raleigh. This article is entitled, End of North Carolina Income Tax May Result in Minimal Benefit Economy. The diversification of North Carolina's tax system is its foremost strength. We can weather fluctuations in the business cycle without swinging wildly from surplus to shortfall. The three pillars of our state tax system on personal income, sales, and corporate income generate more than 90% of all general fund dollars. The personal income tax generated more than half in 2011. But our tax system is narrow, outdated, and unquestionably in need of reform. One proposed reform, the elimination of the personal income tax, would be tremendously destructive to the state economy. It would also necessitate a significant tax hike for low and moderate income residents. The corporate income tax, which generates about 6% of state revenue, is only applied to profits, not losses, and does nothing to threaten the overall survival of business. It impacts shareholders in the form of passive income, and such as dividends and capital gains. Compare this to the personal income tax, which is paid through a progression of marginal rates. The sales tax, which generates about 32% of state revenue, is the most regressive of our major revenue sources because lower-income households pay a greater share of their total income than higher-income households do. The personal income tax is also the mechanism for one of the most beneficial public policies of the last 37 years, the Earned Income Tax Credit. It was vastly expanded under President Ronald Reagan, who called it the best anti-poverty, the best pro-family, the best job creation measure to come out of Congress. North Carolina offers a modest state EITC equal to 5% of the value of the federal credit. Expanding the state EITC would have an immediate and powerful impact for the nearly 900,000 North Carolinians earning low incomes. That would put money in the pockets of those who are most likely to spend it in North Carolina, boosting local economies. Reducing North Carolina's reliance on the personal income tax will necessitate a tax swap, with the sales tax the likely stand-in for revenue generation. A swap will probably require two actions on the sales tax. The first will be the inclusion of goods and services exempt from sales taxation, of which there are many. The second will be to increase the general state rate from 4.75%. Even if the legislature broadened the sales tax base to nearly all services taxed by other states, the rate would need to reach 8.39% to replace half the revenue lost by scrapping the personal income tax. But a loss of $5 billion in revenue would remain. That's one quarter of all general fund revenue raised by the state in a year. It's roughly equivalent to the combined state budget for the UNC system, community colleges, and corrections. Thousands of jobs depend on these investments in the short run, and strong public structures in education, health, public safety, and transportation serve as the foundation underlying economic growth and access to broadly shared economic opportunity. The better choice for North Carolina is to strengthen and reform the three pillars of our tax code. It's entirely possible for lawmakers to reform our system to better align it with the modern economy and ask all North Carolinians to contribute based on their ability to pay. Revenue modernization done in accordance with these principles will spur economic growth, competitiveness, and shared prosperity. Three Triangle Hotels have made Condé Nast Magazine's Reader's Choice Awards list of the 50 best hotels in the South. Although the list was largely dominated by hotels in Charleston, which had five properties in the top 10, the Farrington House Inn in Pittsburgh beat them all by coming in at number 2 on the list, right behind the 21C Museum Hotel in Louisville, Kentucky. Umstead Hotel and Spa in Cary ranked number 18 on the list, and the Washington Duke Inn and Golf Club in Durham ranked number 44. Farrington was the only local hotel listed among the 10 best hotels and resorts in the United States, ranking at number 5, as well as the list of top hotels in the world, where Farrington ranked as number 24 overall. Mike McIlvaney has resigned as Deputy Director for Operations at Raleigh-Durham International Airport and started October 25th in the same post at Doha International Airport in Qatar. McIlvaney was with RDU for 8 years. The airport hasn't yet named a successor. Small but affluent, Qatar juts up like a thumb from the Saudi Arabia's eastern coast into the Persian Gulf. Its economy has been growing at rates of more than 12% since 2006, according to the World Bank. Doha International, the only commercial airport in the tiny country, is operating at and beyond full capacity. A significantly larger facility a few kilometers away is expected to replace it in early 2013. The airport is the main hub of Qatar Airways, which has a fleet of more than 100 mostly wide-bodied jetliners. McIlvaney says he'll help oversee the airport's transition to its new complex. Also at RDU, Dave Young has taken over as airport's Director of Air Service and Development. The second annual Homebrew for Hunger Festival will be held November 17th at West End Public in Chapel Hill to raise money for Porch, a grassroots hunger relief organization to benefit families in Chapel Hill and Carrboro. At the event, presented by Fifth Season Gardening Company, attendees will be able to sample and learn about locally crafted homebrewed beers. It has to be among the top pet peeves of all office dumb, where's my stapler? OFM, an office and school manufacturer in Holly Springs, school furniture manufacturer in Holly Springs, known for its adeptness at guerrilla marketing, has done it again, this time with a contest to find the best idea for protecting an office stapler from being pilfered. Called the Hands Off My Stapler Contest, prizes were awarded for the best ideas, with contestants submitting photos. Coming in at third place was a photo of a stapler hung from the ceiling above a rubber shark in a fishbowl. The second-place winner suspended his stapler with suction cups and stuck it to the underside of his desk. First place went to the person who came up with the idea of attaching a hand grenade to the stapler. A fake grenade, that is. More than 500 students from 10 Wake County middle schools will join University of North Carolina's men's basketball coach Roy Williams at Rollsville Middle School on April 18th. Coach Williams will encourage the students to continue reading at a Ticket to Read Rewards Rally. The visit is underwritten by a grant from Raleigh-based General Parts International Incorporated. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at TriangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.